What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This episode of All the President's Minutes and all episodes of All the President's Minutes are brought to you by Bella Catering, bellacatering.com.au. One of Sydney's great catering companies pivoting to home delivery in this crazy time of COVID. Hopefully, fingers crossed, toes crossed, all the things crossed that they can start getting back out there again. They've been amazing. Glenn, Maria and team, they're awesome. Why the hell cook when you're trying to cater for your family at the moment? Or why the hell just cook in general if you just want to order a whole bunch of delicious food, have it delivered to your house if you're in the Sydney area, and just not have to worry about it. It's really stressful enough. pitching the lines for them. Guys, a really big and condensed week. Thank you so much for following along. We have three amazing episodes for you this week in All the President's Minutes, and then we'll be back to our regular schedule of four. But now, on with the show.
It is feared that the Prime Minister has drowned. A great search is being made for Mr. Holt off Portsea, Victoria. However, no official announcement has been made as to the fate of the Prime Minister. Mr. Holt went for a swim shortly after noon with a friend, Mr. Alan Stewart, a quarantine officer from the Melbourne suburb of Armidale. They swam out into heavy surf on the ocean side of the Mornington Peninsula. Mr. Stewart told police he saw the Prime Minister dive, but he failed to resurface. Mr. Stewart said he made a short search before sounding the alarm. For the details available so far, we cross to ABC News in Melbourne.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Oh my God, we are motoring through the series so far. Around 30 episodes to go. And as some of you have probably heard on this show, I've said a few times that Twitter is not exactly a hellscape for me as some other people. I use it really to curate a list of people that I admire. I don't hate follow anyone. I just basically follow a whole bunch of people that I admire. And sometimes those little Venn diagrams of people that you know start interacting with new people and you go, I don't know that person, but they seem to know all the people I like and seem to be doing good work. And why don't I know this person? And that's exactly the experience that I had with today's guest. I started reading their stuff because I started seeing a friend, you know, dear friend of the show, Stu Coote, and others interacting with him. And I thought, you know, if Stu endorses him, that's a dangerous endorsement, just FYI. But if Stu endorses him, he must be good. And that means something to One Heat Minute Productions crew members out there in the world. He's a Rotten Tomatoes approved film critic for The Jam Report, and he contributes to the AU Review, and you would find his writing and freelance work around the place. Very recently, he's been made the awards editor of Filmotomy. It's my distinct pleasure to welcome Doug Jamieson to All the President's Minutes. Mate, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. A pleasure to be here.
Look, and thank you. I usually sort of kick off every show with, what's your relationship to this movie? We don't know each other deeply, so I can't sort of lean you in one direction or the other. But you know, Is All the President's Men one of your movies? Is Pacula one of your guys? Is this era one of your eras? Tell me what your relationship is to this movie, other than, you know, my attraction to talking to you was largely because of good taste and good writing, rather than necessarily this movie.
My first introduction to this story was through the 1999 comedy Dick, which tells yes. the sort of revisionist right. history of Deep Throat in the form of Kirsten Dunst and Michelle Williams as right. two vapid girls who stumble upon the Watergate conspiracy and essentially bring down Richard Nixon. So with that frame of reference in mind, the sort of 70s New Hollywood period was something I don't think I really came to until I started doing I did a degree in communications, majoring in journalism and screen studies. And obviously we studied this period.
Yes.
So it was basically going through that whole 70s period, devouring all of those films, which really opened my eyes, I guess, to the transition of Hollywood from the studio system into the 70s, where, you know, everything basically changed. And that was how, this was one of the films that we were pointed to watch, obviously, because it was twofold. You know, it was a brilliant film and it involved journalism. So yes. it's the perfect film.
It's the nexus of those two. Yeah, the nexus of those two exactly. topics. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and I had always had a really...
Who are the bumbling Woodward and Bernstein and Dick? Is one of them Will Ferrell?
Will Ferrell, yeah. And I forget the other guy's name. I think he was on either SNL or the Canadian version of SNL. So that they kind of just bounce off each other.
Yeah.
So, like, completely ridiculous. And I mean, that film has a whole bunch of sort of SNL people, Anna Gasteyer, Dave Foley.
Yeah.
Harry Shearer's in it as a sort of, I forget who he plays. One of Nixon's crooks. French Stewart has a cameo. Terry Garr.
It's Bruce McCulloch. That's who
right.
it is.
Yeah,
oh
yeah,
my
yeah,
God.
Yeah.
He's wonderful. Absolutely.
And he
wonderful.
Has this like perfectly coiffed hair and like, it's brilliant. I think that is one of the most underrated comedies. It's very, very silly. And I would hate to think anyone would watch that movie and think it's factual in any way. You could take some history away from learning from that movie. But I guess I was interested in that movie, especially because I've always had a real strong interest in American presidents for some reason. I don't honestly know where that's born from. My only connection is that I was born on November 22, and that's the same date that JFK died.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's where it began.
You know what's so weird? Doug, my daughter's birthday is... My daughter's birthday is the 22nd of November too.
No way. Get out.
Wait.
Wow.
Wait.
Wow.
And you know, we just started really quickly, and I hate sort of running this back always, but Doug and I, you know, we're both Aussies and we are around the same age. And so we both sort of were asking each other the question prior to recording, and I think it's good for us to get it on the record, so to speak, is like, what is our fascination with American politics? What is it? And, yeah. and you know, some of the things that might contribute to it is just like the pure pageantry of it. You know, and for new listeners to the show, you know, if you're not as familiar with Australian politics, there are very strict, extremely strict windows where Australian politicians are allowed to essentially sort of media, have a media campaign, have debates, have anything of the sort, have advertisements about, you know, upcoming policies or their party's approaches to different, you know, sort of hot button political topics, healthcare, immigration, education, like you name it, it's just spin the wheel and basically it gets recycled. Technology, you know, all those things. So there's a very strict window, and there's also a very small amount of money that can be spent. So even the Australian political race, like when is the election going to be called? We have a little bit of, you know, pageantry around there. Then a small campaign trail, again, very concentrated dose, 3-4 weeks. Then a little bit of fallout, transition in government, etc. Sometimes, you know, in basically British-based and obviously Australian-based and anyone in the Commonwealth, Canadian, etc., there can be things like minority governments where, you know, one party is elected, but they have to sort of have a coalition with another party who maybe is along similar political lines, blah-de-blah-de-blah. It doesn't take a long time. Whereas for folks who've been listening to this show, I was originally going to kick it off, you know, sort of a year out from the American election this year, thinking in 2019. ended up kicking it off in very early January of this year. But the American pageantry and lead up to campaigning has really, and discussions of what's going to happen in my next term has been happening in the Trump presidency since January. And it's only the solidification and all the campaigning around the Democratic candidate has been happening all the way up until Biden was officially announced. And then his running mate, Kamala Harris. So if there's just one thing, I would just say it's the show. Like there's a lot more show. It's like they have a better marketing manager because you can't get away from the ads of this thing. It's like constant trailers over and over again of something that's going to happen. And it just doesn't happen in our country.
I think, our election campaigns are, you know, a couple of months, and it seems that Australians complain about that length. that sometimes those are too long, that the ads are on TV for too long. And it's like, that shit goes on for, 18 months to 2 years in America. Like it's almost there, like they start campaigning for their re-election the day they're inaugurated.
Also, there are whole channels. Like we talk about movie sites that are focused on different things, whether it's like, you know, awards or independent cinema, or, you know, that maybe a particular nation cinema, like the AU Review, for example, you know, those sites that lean towards a particular genre, et cetera. But man, whole news networks are made or broken, basically in those discussions. It's a crazy thing. And you know, the other thing, it has been mentioned once on this show before, but I just want to call it out again. United States politics and political scandal and really political fuckery has made wonderful, it's made some wonderful docudramas over the years that are beautifully, aesthetically on point and really dramatically, the drama is very true to life and very authentic, like this movie, all the way to the wildness of like Oliver Stone's Nixon, which is just manic nuts, or, you know, or JFK, which is just, you know, it, in as much as it is very specific and true to some facts, it is also speculative fiction in a larger sense. But, you know, we in Oz, and a sitting Australian prime minister by the name of Harold Holt went for a swim and never came back. And no one fucking cares in this country. Like no one gives a shit. Maybe there was a lot of news at the time, but if an American president went for a fucking swim and then never came back, there would be whole movie genres, whole years, whole investigations, whole like different theories, conspiracy theories. There'd be the zombie version. There'd be porn parodies. There would be everything in under the sun. You'd find out that he was in an Aquaman sequel. Like there would be jokes. Like that doesn't happen. It's gone. Like in 2020, like maybe on this show, I've mentioned Harold Holt more than anyone else in Australia. Like it's so stupid. And yeah, like I just think also a big part of it is, you know, maybe it's this whole cagey outlook, or maybe it's in the past. Maybe we're much more a forthright country as we sort of evolved into 2020. But political sort of politics has been like a taboo to talk about publicly, to wear on your sleeve, unless you are, you know, technically, I guess, an activist. I think that when we were growing up, when there's no talk of it in Australia in the larger sense from the adults that are around you, unless you had, you know, activist parents or very politically engaged parents, et cetera. Now that's completely different. So I feel like, you know, you can have a lot of fun with current Australian political machinations, fun as in, you know, making fun of those things. And also you can be extremely involved and have very vocal people to have arguments with about it. But I think back when we were probably growing up, that was not the case, or not as forthright as it is now.
No, and I think I was always certainly taught, you know, there's two things you don't discuss at a dinner party: it's politics and religion.
Yes,
and it was completely off the table, even in your own dinner table, even in your own family. Like I had no idea who my parents voted for until probably when I got to 18, and it was like, okay, I need some help. Like I need to understand this process. I need to understand the difference between the two parties. We haven't spoken about this for the first 18 years of my life. I have no idea how this works, yet I could tell you how the House of Congress works in the US. Like I could tell you all about how the whole Electoral College works and the history of American presidents. And yet I have no idea how my own local system works.
And we don't know what happened to Harold Holt, to be clear.
No, exactly. I think that the major difference, I mean, it's crazy that a sitting prime minister was allowed to go for a swim on his own in the first place. Like, that would clearly never happen in America.
Never.
He'd be surrounded by Secret Service everywhere they go. So that's how casually it was looked on back then. If you go for a swim on your own, it's all good, and then he doesn't come back. But as a figure himself, I guess he's just not that interesting. Australian politicians as people are nowhere near as enigmatic, as charismatic, as particularly American presidents. I think charisma plays a big part in their ultimate election. You have to be, you know, a great public speaker. You have to connect with people. It's not just about being the smartest guy in the room or the one who gets the votes within the party. Because I think in Australian politics, it's more about who the party wants to push forward rather than who we're choosing. And America is, yeah, there's an element of that in America, but it's still about your connection to the people. And I don't think I couldn't tell you a prime minister that, you know, really, really connected with a large group of people on a very personal level in an enigmatic way. The closest was probably Kevin Rudd, because he felt, you know, not as stiff, particularly coming from, you know, years and years of John Howard. Kevin Rudd felt like a breath of fresh air. But even then, like, compared to people like Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, even George W.
I wasn't even going to say Kevin Rudd, because the problem is that we kind of had the wool, you know, pulled from your eyes, so to speak, once he becomes in power. Yeah. And you see that he's a bit of an egomaniac.
Exactly.
Despite being exceptionally capable and very articulate, and during his entire campaign, he was very much an antidote to what the country had in the conservative prime ministers then. But I even think, like, Bob Hawke is the last prime minister in Australia, and his own party usurped him. Like, he felt like a guy that people could vote for forever. Like, he's at a cricket game sculling beers with punters. Yeah. And people are like, and then we got rid of that guy. And I'm like, that's the party boy. You know, that's the guy for the country and his own party. But look, I think we've had a very a digression laden introduction to you, Doug. So, firstly, thank you for being so game right up front to talk about that. We are now, for folks listening, past the 100-minute mark. We're now at the 104th minute, so literally 1 hour 43 minutes on your dial. We have just heard, or the bridge of the minute, you hear the word rat fucking, which is finally a bit of a description here about political espionage and games to be played. And look, it's an absolutely incredible scene. We have the absolutely incredible Robert Walden, who plays Donald Segretti. We have Dustin Hoffman as Carl Bernstein. Let's hear from these guys having this chat and then starting to lead us into a little bit of a visit from our old mate, Deep Throat, played by Hal Holbrook. Doug and I are going to watch the minute right now, minute 104. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and talk about it.
Fucking. That's right. And you were just doing the same kind of stuff when you were out campaigning for President Nixon.
Let me tell you something. We did a lot worse things in college. Look, let me ask you something, Carl. What would you have done if you were just getting out of the Army, been away from the real world for 4 years, didn't know what kind of law you wanted to practice, and one day you get a call from an old friend asking if you want to go to work for the President of the United States?
Jeez. Chapin was the appointment secretary for Nixon when he called.
Yeah. Listen, if those sinister things really happened, I don't think Dwight knew anything about him. He just did what he was told.
Told by who?
What's the topic for tonight?
What's the topic for tonight? An unbelievable scene. So great. Yeah. I can't get enough of Robert Walden's pregnant pause that concludes the dialogue with Bernstein. Again, we come to this beautiful dark garage. We see Redford in this green underworld silhouettes again. It's stunning stuff. And There's also a great thing, and I don't know if it's a bugbear for you, Doug, but it pisses me off in contemporary movies where people get really shitty Photoshop photos of actors and they put them around their houses and you see them, and it just takes me out of the movie. And I really love in this scene, they've clearly gotten, you know, Robert Walton to give them his like college photo or high school photo or something. It's on the wall in his apartment. And there's just something about him talking now with a little bit more mileage, looking like he's seen a thing or two, and then just seeing his young and hopeful face and talking to Bernstein about what happens when you get an offer from the president of the United States to work for him. And maybe you don't realize where that's going to take you. A real cracker of a minute. I'm so glad that we get to talk about this one.
It's, I mean, it taps into that real conflict of, you know, what do you do when the president asks you to come work for him and then you suddenly realize it was potentially a mistake, like that he's not the man that you thought he was, when, you know, so many people put the president on such a pedestal because they put out that image of perfection, and, you know, nobody's perfect, but Nixon takes it to another level. And how do you speak up and what do you do?
Yeah, it's unfathomable also, because I think that he kind of contextualizes, like, how much in personal disarray would you be coming back from a war? Like, you've been away, you've been likely drafted. He's already got a degree. He's fresh out of uni. He's been drafted, and he goes. You then come back to a world where no one wants you, like, around. Like, you know, Vietnam soldiers in the largest consciousness were, you know, thought of as, you know, there's a lot of conflict. There was, you know, a lot of propaganda about them being war criminals and things like that. And obviously there are examples of, you know, really bad stuff that the war effort was done, but, you know, the end grunt soldier ultimately, you know, not really accountable for the situations they were put in, but maybe the way they acted. And so he comes home and the entire military is thought of in the, probably the worst light that it ever has in the history of the country. And you then get a tap on the shoulder to be elevated out of that. And so he's always been such a deeply sympathetic figure for me in this movie. And I've loved this scene to death for his candor and for actually the, you know, that great thing that movies do, which is make you really deeply empathize with someone who's done questionable shit. Because when you put yourself in their situation, you think maybe I would have done the same thing.
Well, I think that's one of the biggest successes of the movie, is that if you'd looked at the Watergate story from the outside, you feel like everybody in it is a villain. And, you know, to some degree, obviously they are, but they're all under the command of the biggest villain, and they're basically just doing their job.
Yes.
And this movie gives us that insight into that conflict of they know what they're doing is wrong, but they're being told to do it. It's their job. What are you going to do? You can't say no to the president, and you certainly can't say no to his swarm of lackeys who are basically controlling everything for the president. So we do get, you know, it's odd to feel sympathy for someone who is essentially a criminal. And that's one of the masterful things this movie is able to do, particularly for people who only have a base level of the Watergate scandal or of the Nixon presidency and don't realize not everybody was necessarily evil in this situation.
Yeah. And I think all the people that start talking, they're very fascinating individuals, you know, anyone who wants to talk, and keeps talking, and the lengths that they want to go to sort of relieve themselves of the pressure or the burden of what they know is really fascinating. And I just, you know, it's just little details here. It's, you know, Bernstein had basically lost this big fish off of his hook for just a brief moment in the previous minute. And he's now reeling him in again. And, you know, you see the twinkle in his eye that there is an entire industry of these people who have made a game of this, what from an outsider, you're like, are you allowed to send illegal correspondence on the letterheads of your opponents to mess with their campaign? Yeah. And he's like, oh, this is fun. We did it in college. And it's like, the stakes are much lower. But what's crazy is like, oh, that crazy game you played in college because you thought it was a joke and it would be funny, and it's a student election that has basically no bearing on anything other than it's like totemic. You get to be like, hey, I was the president of my school or whatever. Who gives a shit? I mean, pretty foreign for Australian universities as well, and university students.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
who cares? Like, we're not electing anyone at uni. We're barely playing hacky sack. And, you know, I think that's what's kind of interesting to me about their dialogue. It's him reeling him in. It's him getting that. And I just love that right then in that moment, there's an opportunity to keep him on the hook, or it's to ask the toughest question. And I love that both the scene and Bernstein and Segretti, he kind of has gotten everything out of him and he's given his context and he's ready. And Bernstein and Hoffman's performance, it couldn't be cooler.
Yeah.
Kind of goes in for the kill. Like, I love that in that, like, I'm going to ask the big question and it's just going to sit there. And that's how the scene's going to end. And it feels like a lifetime in that minute. And it's just wonderful.
But it shows also, you know, Bernstein's obviously being a fabulous writer, but being able to connect with people, because that's how he gets the information. That's how he gets sources. That's how he does his job. It's not just about the written word. It's where it's coming from. And you're not going to get that if you're not able, I don't want to say play people, because that sounds sort of malicious, but understand how to get that information out of them, not just bully them, not push them up against a wall and demand it, but to slowly reel them in, to play to that person's strengths, to tell them what they want to hear and get what you want out of them without seeming like giving that impression to the person to know that they're almost being played in that way.
It's really funny. A couple of episodes with a really terrific, let's call him a retired film critic and great and filmmaker and great podcaster himself. Sam Fragoso was on the show, and Sam and I were talking about, he was talking about, you know, the central theme or the central thesis of the movie happens when Bernstein and Woodward are standing at Hugh Sloan's door and Debbie Sloan, played by Meredith Baxter, is there and they're having a dialogue with her, trying to talk their way into the door. And he said the central thesis of the movie in his mind was, and I think it's a great reading of the entire exercise, you know, and a great interesting insight into his mind as a filmmaker too, is you've got these two guys trying to say that the best thing for these people is to talk to them. And then there's this bit of naked, I like to call it like naked candor, where Debbie Sloan goes, no, it isn't. And and Redford's Woodward goes, no, it isn't. And I just love that in the context of this moment, because that's what it is. Yeah. It's like you very much get that in that pregnant pause, there is this moment, this tipping point, and we're about to see it in a number of scenes that come up of, I have to tell you information that is going to incriminate me, and there's no more hiding. Yeah. It might not impact me as much as other people, but most certainly there will be an impact. And so I think that that's a real burden for journalists and for subjects of journalism, because it's like you kind of have to clear your name and not.
Yeah, yeah.
And that kind of sounds stupid to say, but it's always a two-hander. It's like and no, and does that make sense? And you know, is it what's best for you? Probably never.
Yeah. I think because, you know, to lie and cheat and steal and all of these crimes that they did in the first place, you had to be comfortable with that on some level. And now you're asking that person to admit what they did was wrong, give you the information, potentially incriminate themselves, potentially lead to jail time. They didn't know what was going to happen once all this information came out. And for a journalist to get that out of someone, there's nothing you can offer them. You can't, it's not like talking to the FBI or the police of offering a plea deal where they're going to give the information and not get in trouble. There was none of that on the other side of the story coming out. So the ability of both Woodward and Bernstein to get that amount of people to do that in the greater context of the greater good just showed how they were able to convince people. And I think that's what the broader movie does, is it really pays tribute to what they were able to do, which so many people couldn't, you know, so many amazing writers, you know, could get to that point, but still need that extra key of the witnesses that wouldn't be able to do it because they wouldn't know how to talk to people and convince them to blow up the presidency, to blow up the White House. Like, that's a huge responsibility for anybody, let alone numerous people that they got to talk.
Yeah. And I think you put it great to the great point of like also these are layers of tactics. You know, when they were strewn out on Bernstein's floor, you know, that led into this scene when they were talking about Segretti before we were introduced to him, they're sort of going, the Segretti and co are not responsible for the break-in. No, they're not responsible for break-in. They're funded by the same people who are funding, but as different, you know, their own individual agents, they're out playing one level of the game. And it's like this 3D chess game where, you know, they're one part of it. And even Segretti himself is having these flooding things in his mind. You imagine that moment of like, oh my, all the things that I was doing was just one part of this greater thing. And so, I think that indecision and that fact that they were just a part of it and the fact that they were doing their job obviously saved some of the folks who ultimately were indicted and were, you know, given more lenient sentences for kind of just like, the more candid people were, the more lenient their sentences were, because ultimately that's what the Senate.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hearings were all about, you know, trying to uncover who was really complicit in all of this. It's really interesting to me. It's like that when you're talking about it and all these things, the connecting point is the question, which is who gave the orders? Because as all these people who say they work so independently, the orders come back to a very small few number of people who then receive the orders from the president of the United States. And it's like, oh, we all were interconnected. This was a big game. It's, you know, this is a great scene because it punctuates an entire sequence of the movie. I've had some great I had some great correspondence from some patrons on the show who wanted me to shout out, and I'll shout out to Greg Christie, who's been an amazing follower, who says, his reading of the Segretti flying across America stuff is about, is sort of in direct correspondence with the Library of Congress scene, you know, where they go through the cards and they get nothing, but then they go through the papers and they get something. And I think that's a good reading. Not something that was as apparent to me, but it's kind of different. The music does come in, so it's sort of similar, different. But yeah, I just think it's a really incredible scene. It's always very thoughtful, and I don't know about you, Doug, but like, they don't make people with faces like Robert Walden anymore. Like, his face is so good. Like, it's it's a real guy, and you know, they did it. Ned Beatty's in this movie, and like, Ned Beatty's another guy. Like, you think of, I recently watched Mikey and Nikki, which is directed by Elaine May. It's got Peter Falk. It's got John Cassavetes. Also has Ned Beatty. And that movie is like the most 70s face movie I can ever remember. It's like real people, real faces, real guys, real women, real like struggling friendships, but just like people who look real and sweaty and in their element and amazing. And
I think that that's one thing I love about All the President's Men is they didn't fill those supporting roles with a bunch of big stars. They really went for real looking people. You know, they had their stars in Hoffman and Redford. Like, they knew they were leading the movie. Let's really cast some really great people to literally maybe do one scene, two scenes, but completely still focus in that moment because they are the best damn person for that role, regardless of what they look like, regardless if they even resemble the real person, because most of these people didn't.
No.
Those scenes are the ones that stick with you because, you know, I even think someone like Jason Robards isn't in it an awful lot and still walked away with an Oscar nomination because he just left an impression. Like, that was his ability to just steal every moment he had in that movie. And I think everybody kind of realized, like, holy shit, like, this is my chance to work in a Redford and Hoffman movie. I'm going to give it my all. And everything in this scene is, it's just etched on his face. Like, he's such a great emotional performer where you can see, you can almost see his mind working, like the realization that, holy shit, like, Richard Nixon is a massive crook and I'm involved and now I'm being asked to snitch on him. Like, there's so much processing going on. As you said, with the pause, it's like he's just taking it all in, and he does such a fabulous job in this scene. It was his moment. He took it.
It's his moment. And I like different acting styles. It's like, he's an actor who feels like, who gets how important teeth are. And I like I know that sounds so stupid, but like, it's like, you, so many people, especially people who are like, are used to, if you've ever interacted in a corporate environment with different people, there are people who sort of have this like toothy, smiley, forcedness about them. And it almost feels like if you've been around it for too long, you can find yourself doing it. And because it's kind of, it's something that it makes an impression, but it's this sort of forced smiley thing. And he has that when he's kind of lying to himself in these moments, which is so wonderful. Yeah. And then he breaks through and you see a more authentic smile. And I think any actor who, and so many people do it in this movie, so this is just like the Robert Walden hour of this show, but it's like, there are so many people who do such wonderful things in this movie, but I think a real credit to an actor who can be in character, be in a role, and then portray something that's inauthentic to that character and then authentic to that character in the same scene. Yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah.
And we haven't even talked about the final bits, which is that I love transition minutes where it feels like there is a key conclusion moment in the minute and then we get into something else. And, you know, you get a great transition moment here because it's like cutting from, you know, the innards of this apartment. looks like a upper middle class apartment by the water. A guy's been in politics, you know, so I guess he's entitled to live in somewhere, a nice place by the water.
Mm.
And then we finally come back to Deep Throat for our second of three visits with him on screen. Hal Holbrook, not really much talking from Redford whatsoever in this minute, because we move on to the next minute to get to some more underground rat fucking. But in this moment, there's just this unbelievable silhouette shot. It feels like it could be the shot of the movie.
Yeah.
And then Hal Holbrook sort of going, what is it for today? And it's just a really magic little transition. It's a magic introduction. And it's like, I also love this as a moment, as like a great, you know, what's the topic for today? It feels like that's how I should introduce every guest. What's the topic for today?
This was one of those movies, when I first watched it while studying, I was focusing on the screenplay and the acting, and that's kind of how I'd always watch movies. Like, those are the two things that stand out. And then I think studying film teaches you to look for other things, and it's the cinematography, it's the lighting, it's, you know, every other element that comes into it that sometimes you don't notice and sometimes you do. And then, you know, I do remember our lecture was kind of like, watch this a second time and really focus on the visuals, and particularly the car park scenes, because they are some of the most, like, simple but really, really beautiful. And as you say, like, that silhouette moment is very typical of that. And that's not something I had necessarily appreciated in a first watch. And that's something you would encourage people to go back and watch again, because you're not necessarily noticing those things. It's a dark car park, okay, but it has been structured in a very, very specific way.
That's the thing that you relish. You know, if you ever watch a movie once and you love it and it inspires you back for multiple reviewings, or, you know, or you find yourself not being able to turn it off when you stumble upon it on streaming services or on channels, or if you've got a subscription to a cable service or whatever. And so even for me in this project, it's so fascinating that so many people go, oh, look at all the preparation and all the authenticity, and even discovering new things that are even more authentic. Like, you know, they shot the scene of at Judith Hoback Miller's house where the bookkeeper was and those sorts of things. But in this underground car park, it is just so stunning to have this and this feeling. So the feeling is you've been relishing and looking forward to another moment because you know that this is an important figure, but it always comes with this sort of ominous sense that, especially now leading up to the stakes of this movie growing, it's like you can really start to marvel at the craft of like, wow, you know, in all these other scenes that are brightly lit and colorful, and look at this knitted sweater that I might want to own. The next scene is I'm in an underground car park.
It looks
green. My face looks off colored and weird. And, and then you get down to these characters who are just like shrouded in shadows, and it's a shadow play. And it's just, I mean, the lighting of Willis lighting just these, you know, just his irises,
just the irises,
and then not lighting other things, and then bathing, you know, using all natural light. It's just really special.
I think every sense of dread in this movie comes from those car park scenes.
Yeah, I agree.
Without them, you know, obviously it's based on fact. That's where they really met, but they've chosen to frame it and light it and film it in a very specific way to add to that rising sense of tension that, are they being followed? Is someone onto them? You know, are they about to be murdered? You just don't know. if you knew nothing of the story, you could be like, they're not going to get away with this. You know, someone's going to catch on. Someone's going to find out what they're doing. It's going to get shut down. Someone's going to turn up in a car park. Yes. And those scenes are where all of that comes from. The tension of what they were attempting to do and the threat of what they were under is all contained in those moments. That you know, they really put their lives on the line to get this story. And I don't think we see that these days.
No, it's at a moment not too dissimilar from the moment we're in now, where journalism wasn't really held up to the regard that it had once been. There was a more hostile political environment against journalists that didn't back them. They didn't necessarily have a full Murdoch-backed propaganda machine behind it, but they certainly had a hostility towards the media, who they perceived to, you know, have political allegiances that weren't of their own, and you know that, that's without saying directly, you know, that's without necessarily calling all of their reporting, you know, politically slanted away from the Nixon administration, but particularly this story, the fact that they held on and they lingered with it, and you know, ultimately it was the Post and then coming back. I feel like I think we're not going to find out about the journalists who truly put their lives on the line until.
No.
Other than the people who were just walking the streets during the Black Lives Matter protests, who literally put their lives on the line because the police were shooting at the journalists. It wasn't like secret back dealings, 11 months and 12 months of telling a story. It was just like, we were just walking the street that day and Trump wanted the plots cleared, so they had their lives.
Exactly. But I think like the biggest thing that they were up against was that Richard Nixon was a wildly popular president at the time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he, you know, in his re-election, he won 49 out of 50 states. He had one of the biggest landslides in American history.
Wait. Just repeat that.
Yeah.
49 out of 50.
Yeah. Oh, I think he lost, I think it was Massachusetts or Minnesota, one of the M's. That was the only state he didn't carry in his re-election. It was a slaughter because that's how popular he was. That's why the whole Watergate thing doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because he didn't necessarily need to do it, but he was so fearful of losing. He was so desperate to hold on to power, and he was so desperate to be loved and liked, you know, which is sort of similar to Trump in a lot of ways, that he would go to any means to get there. But in reality, he didn't need to do any of it. He was going to win the election. You know, he had achieved a lot in his first 4 years. He got America out of Vietnam. I think he did some desegregation work in the South. He was a great diplomat to China. He was actually a really good president. And the problem is now his entire presidency is defined by this one moment. the first introduction I had to Richard Nixon was he's a crook. Like yeah. that's synonymous with his legacy, unfortunately, when in reality, his actual presidency was full of amazing achievements and his re-election was one of the biggest landslides in history. So for them to tackle such a popular president, regardless of what he had done wrong, it was an enormous challenge. And you could see that's why people weren't willing to talk about him, because it's just like, but he is the president and everyone loves him. I think his approval rating was something in the high 60s, 68, 69, something like that, which is more than we've seen for any president in my lifetime, certainly.
Yeah.
You get very, very divisive figures that usually hover around that 50%, but he was well over that. And yet he was doing some crazy, crazy things that didn't need to be done.
I think Nixon teaches a great lesson, though, of the lack of logic, or I guess just the yeah. total irrationality
yeah.
Of power.
Power.
And it's like the famine mentality. Once you've got like this unbelievable, unfathomable power, the famine mentality that any of it is going to be called into question leads to utter irrationality. And so when people are like, yeah. well, they're so powerful or so rich or so influential, why would they do X? And it's like, that ultimately makes you do weird shit. Like to be, yeah. you know, like, you know, for all the criticism that he's currently getting, I do, I have listened to and enjoyed much of Joe Rogan's podcast for many years. And one time I remember him talking, or maybe he said it many times, but it was just like, when you're talking about a representative government and you have to ride on horseback between towns, it makes a lot of sense for how the current American administration is set up. When you yeah. have the yeah. internet, it does not make any sense. Like, for example, you know, where yeah. the big one, and you would know this about, you know, just the sort of the political gerrymandering, if you like, of the different senators and what, you know, what the population footprints that are under each of those representatives. It's like, hey, you guys have in, say, California or, say, New York City, you guys have got like 20 million people, 15 million people, 20 million people or so. That's like 10% of the population in two cities. They have as many senators as people who, you know, have like 800,000 people total. Correct. Who live in that state. Yeah. And so yeah. it just seems kind of ludicrous in those ways that it hasn't evolved ever with population or cities or whatever those things. But that's it, just especially now, you know, we're in 2020, it's a pandemic. You see these companies and people make really kind of rash decisions with power and you're like, what are these people doing? But that's, you know, Nixon is a great figure in that no matter what you think about him, his very existence and his life and his ultimate downfall from political life is like a case study, and this film and this story yeah. is like a case study of like power corruption and
yeah
those
yeah.
messy things that happen. It's always a complete fascination to me and probably endlessly discussable on this show, but also like outside of the show, it's something I ponder as well, going like, it's the thing that never makes sense that only in this movie they address mere minutes ago, which is like, why, when you are winning, it's almost like being the only way to describe it is like being a boxer, like Mike Tyson fighting me and Mike Tyson is beating me up. And then in the 11th round, I wouldn't last 11 rounds, halfway through the first round when I'm dying on the floor and like, yes. can't get up anymore, he gets his friend to come in the ring and shoot me. Like that's basically
yeah, yeah.
Watergate.
Yeah.
Like it's like,
yeah, exactly.
You don't need to shoot him or shoot me rather. I'm dead. Like it's over. Like yep. it's just wait yep. two more seconds for the ref to count him out. And so that's the whole thing that I just endlessly go like, why? And it's like, well, it has to be that famine mentality of I'm going to lose one skerrick of power or influence in this moment. I have to do anything, even if it's the irrational anything, to guarantee that it is not going to stop.
And I think that's why we've seen Nixon appear in several films, you know, several TV shows. There's, you know, endless books written about him. He is someone that, you know, for people who don't really know presidents, you ask them to name another president besides the current president, and he would likely be one of them. He has transcended pop culture in a way because he is such a fascinating figure of contradictions, of confusions, of shit that just doesn't make sense about his presidency. You know, he would record every conversation he had because he was that paranoid. That and then some of those tapes.
That sounds like me, Doug.
Yeah. It's the age we live in now where it's like, I'm not going to call you. I'm going to put something in email because I need it on record. Like, I can understand it to a certain degree, but he was just terribly, terribly paranoid, despite being one of the most popular presidents in modern history. It still wasn't enough. And you're right. It is the personification of absolute power corrupting absolutely. Yes. And it just completely fucked with his mind to the point where he would do something like Watergate, which just in retrospect just seems so illogical and so stupid and gave him absolutely nothing and ended up killing his presidency. It's such a juxtaposition. It's such a ludicrous thing for a president to do.
Yeah. And, you know, we you've mentioned it a couple of times as I have. It's like, I mean, Trump's got Watergates like
every week.
And
that's the strange thing, because knowing this story, knowing this movie, every time I hear kind of one of these scandals, you hear people say, oh, this is going to be his Watergate, and then a few days later we move on to the next Watergate and the next one. Whereas, I mean, it shows the changing attitude of the Republican Party is that when all of this came out about Nixon, they all turned their back on him. He was immediately, it was either resign or we will impeach and we'll remove you. Whereas with Trump, it was like he was actually impeached and they still stood behind him. They still allowed him to stay. Nothing happened, no consequences. Yet he has done so much worse in so many ways than, you know, breaking into an office building, which at the end of the day, it was not that bad, but it was the lies and the corruption around it. I get it, but...
I know this is going to sound weird, so just go with me. I almost wanted to have someone break into the Democrats.
Yes.
Let's give it a crack. Let's run it back. Yeah. Let's see what happens.
You never know. Yeah.
You never know. Because like with a drone,
that's the one thing.
With a drone, you can do way worse than these guys were ever going to do with a bug. Like, let's see if he just has a crack. Just break in somewhere, Trump. Do something. Because for me, it's like, grab them by the pussy, tell people to do illegal things, and then the only reason that they don't is because they have a care about their country and you're still there. Like, get impeached, you know, have scandals with Russia, have scandals with money, like go golfing for like more days in your presidency than actual days being the president. It's just like, know about the pandemic and then not tell anyone about it. And just it's like the list goes on. It's like, maybe you should just break into a hotel room. Maybe. Let's just see if that does it.
Every time it happens, I'm like, oh, okay, this is it. We're in for the Watergate moment. No, Stormy Daniels. Oh, no, we move on from that. Oh, you know, his pandemic response. No, we move on from that. Like, it's such a different time. And
the tax right now, as we're talking, it's the tax.
Yeah.
That he pays $750 in tax. Yeah. And then for folks internationally, it's like one of our billionaires, not one that currently runs your media, another one, Kerry Packer in Australia, was famously added through freedom of information and journalism that he like paid like $1 of tax as a billionaire in this country because everything went through his businesses and, you know, there was a suitable amount of outrage. But he was also a bit of a cult of personality kind of guy, so he kind of definitely got away with it. And, you know, these old school business guys, that's how they live their life. Like, you know.
But Kerry Packer wasn't leading our country. You know? He was just a business. Oh, but thankfully, sure he would have liked it.
Doug, you know, I might have to do the old Michael Corleone line from The Godfather Part 1. Who's being naive now, Doug?
Yeah.
Like well, Kerry Packer was basic. He ran cricket and NRL football. Yeah. And he basically ran in the 80s and 90s. He basically ran our country, you know, like you
remember.
he definitely had some strong political influences at the time.
That's true.
But yeah, you know, I mean, this is where it's like, you know, even if you just tax the rich as much as you and I get taxed, I'm good with that. I'm just happy with that. That's the bracket. Yeah. Not even 50%, just whatever I get taxed. Cause I feel like I'm paying out the ass every year. I look at my tax return and I'm like, you son of a bitch. Like, hey, how much do I have to pay? And I'm like the little guy by, you know, in the grand scheme of things. And it's like, you know, and they're like, Jeff Bezos paid no tax. And you're like, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh?
I'd love to pay $750. Sounds great. That,
$750
that
sounds good.
Yeah.
You guys you guys pay 30%. We'll pay $750 from here on out, and that we'll call it quits. Oh my goodness, Doug, man,
I can't imagine. Just one more thing. I just can't imagine what the journalists who would watch a film like this see the result of something that Woodward and Bernstein had done, and then see them release similar sort of stories and it go nowhere. So that they would put in similar types of effort, that they would put out a story of the same magnitude and see it basically become, you know, the bottom of the birdcage the next day because we move on. And this film would stand as a tribute to what, you know, journalism used to be able to do, the effect it could actually have.
Yeah, look, it's. I think those kind of journalists just have to do what everyone's doing right now in 2020. And you and I, you more than me, you know, in the film journalism game broadly and doing different things, it's like the entire world, the entire paradigm has shifted. Like there's all years before, and then there's 2020. And the 2020 of it all is, I think it's, and Watergate is very much like this. It is there. Watergate was a stream. It was not just a couple of signposts. It was a stream of stories and a stream of revelations and growing revelations and increased pressures. And also then the great thing that we haven't so much talked about, because it never actually eventuates in the film, but it's like it only does in tangential ways, which is like, you know, the FBI go back and say they're going to investigate something because we didn't realize that John Mitchell was in charge of the XYZ. But it's the stream and the constant push of these stories. It's then the garnering of the public interest. It's the media chorus. It's then moving law and order institutions like the police or like, you know, intelligence agencies to investigate things. It's like, well, this was uncovered. How do we do this? And so I think those journalists who are out there just need to like keep pushing their stream of stories and keep trying to keep tying them together and keep talking about it, because at the end, the collective weight may be that someone is not elected. But I think that that's the thing that we, you know, there are so many thankless, you know, I imagine, you know, I always talk about fighters because I'm a big fight fan. It's like there are so many thankless and countless hours that a fighter will get up in the morning and run for an hour on the road. They call it their road work. And they just do these thankless hours. And it's not for that day. It's for the championship that they fight for 10 years later. And it's like, if you ran every single day and you ran 10 kilometers and you ran, you know, whatever it is, you know, you're running thousands and thousands of kilometers and you're running for hours and hours and hours and hundreds of hours, maybe even thousands of hours. And it's like at the end of that, you just hope that you've made an impact.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in 2020, I think the only thing that these guys can take solace in is that they're still making an impact. They still have work to do, you know, freshen up, get some rest, 15 minutes and get your asses back in gear, you know. Like that's the, all those folks who might be disheartened, I would just say, yeah, freshen up 15 minutes and get your asses back in gear, because we need you. We need you to keep writing. We need you to keep finding this shit. And then hopefully, you know, hopefully one of these will stick. And if it doesn't stick, hopefully it doesn't get reelected. If it does, I don't know what the hell we're going to do, Doug. I don't
want to even consider it, but yeah, I think that there's the possibility that there were writers that tried to do stories about other presidents and got nowhere. So for all these people that are getting nowhere, it's like that's happened before, but then Woodward and Bernstein are the, you know, the gold standard of what can happen when it does work. And maybe that can still happen these days. We just have to keep hoping.
Yeah, look, it's a different time, but paradigms are shifting all over. And so, you know, I think the time is now to just keep doing it. You got to keep doing the damn thing, because the world's changing and the landscape's changing. And, you know, the old guard is also going to start changing too, because, you know, I mean, short of Futurama coming true and heads being able to live in jars, I think Rupert Murdoch and his empire will eventually disband, you know, and that's going to change the landscape. And, you know, and hopefully the American population doesn't turn into a complete dictatorship just sometime soon, because they kind of have all the nukes. And That would not be fortunate for anyone. But it's just one of those things. You just got to keep fighting the good fight. But look, it's been a real pleasure talking to you about it, Doug. It's awesome.
Thank you.
And I've really appreciated you. Where can people best find your stuff?
The best place is probably my website, The Jam Report, which is thejamreport.com. And then with award season, I mean, it's going to be a very strange award season because it's going for a lot longer. The Oscars are in April, you know, eligibility's changed. It's going to be a wild one. So I'll be doing award season coverage over at filmotomy.com, where I'll be the awards editor. So predictions, you know, for your considerations, all that kind of stuff to come.
Huge thank you to Mr. Doug Jamieson for being a part of the show. If you want to find Doug, you just go to @itsdougjam on Twitter. You can also go to The Jam Report, which is thejamreport.com. And basically, if you go to those two places, you're going to find everything that he's doing. I like Doug a lot. I've been interacting with him quite a bit on Twitter. That's where I found him. And he's one of the good ones. Guys, thank you so much for listening. Again, a really condensed week here on All the President's Minutes. So thank you for just weathering the storm of a stack of different episodes all dropping all at once, including a new episode in our series, a special limited series, Three Hands. I've been Blake Howard, One Blake Minute on Twitter and Instagram, @ATPMPod. You can find us on Twitter. OneHeatMinute.com is our website. Mail@OneHeatMinute.com is where you can email us. And finally, if you've got a little bit of extra scratch, Patreon.com/OneHeatMinute. And if you don't, share, retweet, review, text this to someone, for God's sake. We love your support. Thanks so much for listening. Another banger on its way.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.